David?
All right. Okay, so what I'm going to, I'll try to move exactly on the reason for report. What I'm going to do with this talk, what I'm going to do is actually how to apply physics to game theory, as opposed to econo physics, which tries to apply physics to economics. This is about how to get the microscopic features of the system right. The microscopic ones are game theory, whereas it's the macroscopic ones that are the economy. And I would claim that you can't do any kind of physics on the economy until you get the microphysics right. And this is about a way to try to get the microphysics game theory correct. So tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of articles all about applying statistical concepts within games, where the players are themselves statisticians, or in some sense stochastic. There is, until this work, nothing about how to apply statistics to games. So the whole perspective here is that we are scientists outside of the game who have to make a prediction about how the game outcome will arise. And that means that we have to use our standard statistical machinery to predict the outcome, which is completely different from the way the conventional game theoreticians do things. They don't think as scientists, they think as mathematicians. No, they themselves actually will say that. I'll try to make that clear later on. Then I'm talking about doing statistics. I'm going to be applying a Bayesian statistical framework to doing this. And the likelihood function in this is going to be based on something that's quite popular in the game theory community. It's called a quantile response equilibrium. And know that word quantile does not mean what you and I might think it means. In this Bayesian approach, I'm going to use it. Then I'm going to, hopefully, there's a collaboration I'm doing with an economist right now. And every year in the US, weather disruptions cause the airlines to lose about $30 or $40 billion. Some people are looking into actually how to use dynamic auctions amongst the airlines when there's a weather disruption to try to actually make the entire system more efficient. Right now, nobody has ways of actually predicting how any of those auctions will actually play out. We are doing that. And then, time allowing, I'll talk about some new mathematical tools coming out of all of this. My dad, I have to say that for this audience, but please feel free to interrupt. if you're like me, after about slide two, number three, you tend to zone out. So hopefully you at least stuck with me to this point, because this is, in a certain sense, the only idea in this talk. Human beings are physical objects. We should use the same machinery to analyze and predict and control these physical objects as we do for everything else. But there is one hell of a big kicker. These are not like your conventional particles. There's not one single Hamiltonian to govern them all. There are as many Hamiltonians as there are human beings. It's a multi-Hamiltonian problem, very, very loosely speaking. And that makes doing inference, induction statistics, a subtle exercise. Though there are going to be a lot of parallels with statistical physics, as I'll show. Okay, I've always got to use different jargon depending on whether I'm using this to computer scientists, to economists, to physicists. This is the slide that I usually whip through, but now I'll go through it with a little bit of care. It's crucial that everybody understand the next two slides, reviewing game theory. You're going to get game theory 101 in two slides. This is the simplest kind of a game. This is what's called a single-shot strategic form game. Prisoner's Dilemma is a very famous example of this. You've got N independent players. Each of them have a possible set of moves. In the game theory community, those are called their strategy spaces. And each player also has a probability distribution. In the community, that's called a mixed strategy. So I might sometimes accidentally use that term, mixed strategy, to refer to the distribution, whereas pure strategy is the move. And the players are independent, so the actual joint distribution is just a product of their separate mixed strategies.
Do I label each player?
Yes.
So X, but then maybe the J labels one of the possible, I mean, there should be. It's XI is a member of capital XI.
Yeah, so it's just notation. So I'm just saying capital XI is a set of possible moves.
For that player.
For that player. And small XI is going to be a particular instance.
I see. Okay, thank you.
So just quickly.
Great.
And thank you for interrupting. Now, here's where life becomes fun. You're multiple Hamiltonians. And by the way, you want to increase utility functions. You don't want to decrease them like energy. But each player has associated with him or her a utility function, which is a map from the joint move, X, of all the players, to a real number for that particular player. By the von Neumann-Morgenstern axioms of utility theory, what every player, every human being, wants to do is to have it be the case so that the expected value of their utility under the joint distribution is as high as possible. The kicker, alas, is that I am not a dictator. My expected utility depends upon the joint distribution of everybody in this room, but I can only control myself. Lee?
So I guess I don't know what a move is.
A move is
on my moves or on everybody's?
Everybody's moves. When I've got no subscript, that means the joints. We're using that.
And what's the difference between a move and a configuration? Would this be the same if you said that there's a space of configuration?
Yes.
And you can move around in the space of configuration?
You can only move yourself. So if you want to view it this way, you've got a set of spins, and each spin in this room, we've got not necessarily the same number of states that I can be in. And so X is the joint configuration of all the spins. XI is whatever state I'm in. And I've got a probability distribution across mine, and so is everybody else. And it's independent.
So does chess fit into this? So I have my pieces, the configuration.
Yes, because in chess, what you do is your actual move is the entire algorithm with which you are going to play chess.
So the moves can depend on where the configuration of the game is.
We'll take that offline. What you're raising is a wrinkle that I think will probably confuse most people. For now, just think of it as simply everybody's doing the same thing simultaneously. So we're all playing matching pennies. If it is the example of chess, what happens is you write a computer program to play chess. I write a computer program to play chess. They then go off and play the programs, but my move is whatever program I choose to write, and your move is whatever program you choose to write. So it's still a simultaneous move game at the level of you play against me. Because okay. that's the way game theoreticians deal with this issue. They roll everything up, and they just make the move space be your entire algorithm that you're going to use for a big multi-stage process. So everybody wants to maximize their own expected utility, but the problem is that you can only set your own mixed strategy, your own probability distribution. That is what all game theory, people were concerned about for over a century. The question is, if you were given just that information, and here I'm going to be really leading, I'm going to say, if you were given just this data about how a set of players or human beings are going to interact, your job, shall you choose to accept it, is to predict what joint mixed strategy is going to arise. So given the language that I just used, to you and me, what that means is you're going to have a posterior distribution over joint mixed strategies. That's not the way that mathematicians, game theoreticians, and all economists view it. They instead want what is called an equilibrium concept, which is hopefully a single value mapping from the utility functions to a single joint mixed strategy, and they say no other ones can occur. This, I'm not going to say who it is, but this is a quote, actually several people say it's actually the same thing. All that we have to do to be able to figure out, yeah?
So you mean by equilibrium, a configuration of utility functions evaluated in certain strategy that will make a delta function in the distribution?
No, it's a mapping. So the equilibrium concept says if you start with the utility function, that's your data, then this equilibrium concept is going to map that to a single joint mixed strategy, which is a probability distribution.
Which is a probability distribution by itself. Okay.
Yeah. And so you can see where equilibrium is not too far off. It's kind of analogous to the notion of an equilibrium.
So you change the utilities of the player, the distribution will change.
Bingo. And so what a lot of people will actually say, this is sort of canonical in game theory and all economics, is that we want to actually figure out what's going on in the financial markets right now. And if we did know all the utility functions, then all we would need to do, our problem, the only difficulty is finding the correct equilibrium concept. Once we know this magic function, ka-chunk, we can sit down and predict everything. Here are two examples.
First one, Nash equilibrium. This is what's called a full rationality, homoeconomics. This equilibrium concept says, okay, you give all the utility functions of all the players, and the only possible joint mix strategy that counteracts probability 1.0 is going to be the one in which everybody individually says, given what everybody else is doing, I don't want to change mine. I wouldn't improve my expected utility. So I'm saying that, given what everybody else is doing, I don't want to change my distribution. Chris says the same thing. Lee says the same thing, and so on and so forth. We are all saying this simultaneously. A good chunk of the reason why Nash John Nash went to Stockholm and for Oslo, I guess, and got himself a nice little movie made about it, is for a two-page proof, which is actually very, very beautiful, of the fact that there must always be such a solution for any game and any number of players. It's Kakutani's fixed point there. The problem, though, is that, yeah, every game's got to have such a solution, but there can be more than one. So economists, thankfully, did not actually manage to push through their whole program of coming up with a unique equilibrium concept. And so there's been decades of work trying to somehow tweak Nash equilibrium to actually get a single answer out. Here's the other one that I'm going to be talking about, which should look very, very reasonable to everybody in this room. It's what they call a quantum response equilibrium. And basically what it means is, no, it's not the case that I do perfectly given what everybody else is doing. I play Boltzmann distribution. Where again, utilities go up rather than down, so you don't have a minus sign. Okay, so the notion here is that if it were Nash, I would, at a Nash equilibrium, I'm doing the best thing that I can, given what everybody else in the room is doing. Here, I'm instead playing a Boltzmann distribution over my possible moves.
Given what everybody else is doing.
Given what everybody else is doing. And we all do this simultaneously. So we're all our own little teeny canonical ensembles, with everybody else being our environments. Okay? That's called quantum response.
Should that be normalized by the total?
It's proportional to.
Okay, yeah, sorry, yes.
So, and by the way, they don't even know the word Boltzmann distribution. Economists will call it Logit distribution. L-O-G-I-T. Things like that. Of course, when one of us sees this, it starts screaming, oh, there are connections here with statistical physics. You will not find a word to that effect in the literature. It's viewed as a crude model of bounded rationality. You know, and it's not going to be the case that I'm just doing perfectly. It's in fair agreement with experiment. It's actually got a nice kind of intuition. What it means is that you are fully rational when you are frozen, when you're zero temperature. So quite literally, somebody who's purely rational is a very cold person. Whereas somebody who's doing a lot of exploration and bounding all over the place is a hot person. So that's kind of cool. And actually, for finite systems, you don't get phase transitions. You actually get cusp and fold catastrophes, bifurcations. And there seems to be a whole strong connection with that. I'm investigating that with some folks at the Max Planck. Basically, I'm characterizing the discontinuous jumps in the surface as you tweak the parameters. So those are the two equilibrium concepts I'll be talking about, Lee, for the talk.
What kind of experiments are used to check this at this level?
There's sort of epistemological problems with them, but basically, I'm not checking other things, I've done these experiments. You get a bunch of approximations of human beings, they're called undergraduates. You get a bunch of them together, and what you basically do is you've got some money, you've got to make it real, and you have them play something like this repeatedly, say anonymously across computer screens with one another and so on, and you tabulate how well they did. So all of them, for example, in the simple case here, all the students, you would tell them, here's everybody's utility functions. Now go off and make your move, and you'll get money back based upon how well you do.
You kind of rule out as out of bounds is kind of a naive question, but I mean, most games that I know are very challenging intellectually to find out, to figure out what the right move is. And the utility function is trivial, you want to win. So,
you're thinking of games like chess and so on. I'll get to a Game theory, you're thinking of a multi-stage kind of thing like chess.
Well, I just want to know what the word game means in the definition of game.
Chess is a particular kind of a game, but more generally, for example, you know rock, paper, scissors?
Yes.
Rock, paper, scissors. So, or here's another example. Taking a penalty kick in soccer. The two players are the goalie and the person who's taking the shot. And in that game, actually, the goalie, of course, the goalkeeper has to make their decision and to jump before actually the shot is taken. And same for the other person, if they're actually good players. And so actually, in that case, what the optimal strategy for the keeper is to randomize both directions. Serving and tennis, the same kind of thing. And you actually find that if you do the analysis, people who are actually top of the levels, professionals, they actually do randomize very, very well. Whereas just hacks like us, we have a difficult time actually properly randomizing, properly sampling from problems.
So this is the claim of the success of this theory?
Oh, that's one of them. Yeah. I mean, there are many. There are many problems and there are many successes. There's both. Okay, so that was game theory. Quiz at the end of the class. Here's a lightning review of statistics, probably somewhat different from what at least some people in the room have seen. You can have all kinds of desiderata, Diffinetti's axioms, Cox's axioms, and so on, that basically come out and say that if you don't know everything about a system, the only consistent reasoning way that you can use for it is to use probability theory. It's the only consistent calculus of uncertainty, according to all many different types of desiderata. In particular, probability theory, about a half of the line proof from axioms of probability theory was known as Bayes' theorem. The probability of any particular truth Z, conditioned on some knowledge, data, whatever you want, I guess that's iota, is proportional to what's called the likelihood, which is the probability of the knowledge given the truth, that's this term here, times the prior. That's this term there, P of Z. The prior is basically before you know anything whatsoever about the system, and then the likelihood says, okay, if a word is the truth, what would be the probability of my knowledge or data, what have you? And this is called Bayes' theorem. Savage's axioms then say the following. Let's say I give you that conditional probability distribution on the left-hand side. That's called a posterior distribution. And then I also give you a loss function, telling you if you make a prediction Y, and the truth is Z, this is how much you pay. So a very simple one, if Z and Y are real values, would be a quadratic loss function, for example. More generally, let's say that you're Paulson going before Congress, and the Congress is asking you to make a prediction. Your loss function is going to depend upon things like, well, do you want to stay in this job for another 6 months, or do you want to bail anyway? Because that's going to determine how much pressure you would get, depending on you making a particular prediction about the future when it turns out to be something different. Okay? According to Savage's axioms, once I give you a loss function and give you the posterior probability distribution, your best guess, according to the axioms, what's called the Bayes-Offen prediction, is to make the one that minimizes your expected loss under that distribution. So, to give an example, if a loss function is quadratic, like I mentioned a second ago, then the Bayes-Offen prediction is the mean. And that can be viewed as a legitimate way of why you might want to characterize a probability distribution with the mean. If your loss function is quadratic, that's actually the optimal thing. What you're going to be doing is minimizing your expected loss, according to like quadratic loss. Very, very often, a good approximation to this is given by the mode. The mode is often a good approximation to the mean. And that's called the maximum a posteriori, or MAP prediction. This is going to all, right now, this is presumably going to have some of you looking a little bit weird, but I'm going to basically in the next page recapitulate Jane and derive all statistical physics just from this. So here's the notion, probability theory to reason about physical objects when we have some uncertainty. This is going to be whether these physical objects are molecules in the room or human beings playing a game. And then if you also have a loss function and you want to distill that probability distribution down to a single prediction, like you're Paulson, you go before Congress, you can bet Congress isn't going to take it as an answer from you. Here's the probability distribution of what will happen. They're going to want a single answer, a single prediction. then you should minimize expected loss under that distribution to make your single prediction. Okay? This is coming by real fast. I'm pulling together a bunch of different fields here, statistics, game theory, and
What is E sub P?
Sorry?
E sub P.
Oh, the expectation under P.
So
the notion is a probability distribution, P of Z, mm-hmm. and I want to distill that down to make a single prediction. Mm-hmm. And if I've got a loss function, that's saying if I make prediction Y, but the truth happens to be Z, mm-hmm. here's how much it hurts me, mm-hmm. then I can do a search. Try to find the prediction which would minimize my expected loss under this distribution.
So E of P is a function of a fact, Z, or there's some fact?
No, it's a distribution over Z's.
It's a distribution over Z. So I take a Z and I put it in E of P and I get a number.
No. You take a Z and a Y and you put it into L and you get a number.
Right.
And then if you take a Y, if I give you a particular Y, I can then, without specifying Z, I can say, okay, for example.
So shouldn't it be L of EP comma Y?
No, let's just start the way that Savage's axioms actually come out. Where you just run these through R. It's saying, actually, if you think about it, sure, it doesn't really go that way. It's right from my face. So for example, if the loss function, Z and Y, mm-hmm. is Z minus Y squared, and you've got some distribution P of Z, mm-hmm. then your expected loss under P for any particular Y, because I'll just quickly write this way. That's not technically speaking correct. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be the integral over Z, P of Z, Z minus Y squared.
Got it. Okay, thank you. Excellent, thank you.
We just want to find the Y that minimizes it, and here, trivially, is actually going to be the mean of Z. But for different loss functions, there will be different kinds of beasts. Mm-hmm. And very often, the mode is a good approximation. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole huge field on Markov chain Monte Carlo that's all about Monte Carlo. It's all about how to try to calculate these kinds of things for Bayesian scenarios when your spaces get very big. Lots of numerical crunching is involved. Okay. So, now I'm going to run the canonical ensemble from that. Well, James did, actually. Let's be a little bit funky. Let's say the Z, this truth, is itself a probability distribution. So we're talking about probabilities of probabilities. The reason that's going to be appropriate is because if you remember in game theory, what players do is choose probability distributions. Well, they're not the only ones who do it. If that's what Z is, then we are counseled by Bayes' theorem that to get the posterior distribution, given some knowledge, we have got to do a prior and a likelihood. And we're going to look at that for the particular case where Z is itself a probability distribution across some space. Well, an appropriate prior, appropriate P of Z, when Z is a probability distribution, is what's called the entropic prior. There have been tons of experiments in signal processing, machine learning, robotics, and so on, all kinds of biological problems that actually validate that the entropic prior works well. Given that entropic, and where S of is this Shannon tree, so what that basically is saying is that if I give you two probability distributions, but one is flatter than the other, that a priori, without knowing anything else, I'm going to say the one that's flatter is more likely. The world likes to be flat. It doesn't like to have peaks. By looking at the same way you can validate anything in statistics, or for that matter in science, by looking at the associated predictions and seeing how well they match the data. And for right now, I'm going to show you, for example, that this one makes predictions that you've heard of before called the canonical ensemble. That's the entropic prior. Let's say that this is what we know about this probability distribution Q. Let's say I happen to know the expectation value of something, you might want to call it a Hamiltonian,
under Q. I know that value. So that's my data. That's my knowledge.
That's just a number. OK? Kind of equivalent to numeric thermostat. Let's give you an example of that number. So that's what you know, is expected value of the Hamiltonian. OK? Well, recall Bayes' theorem. Go back. Bayes' theorem. Probably a truth given knowledge is proportional to going the other way. For us, truth is a Q. Knowledge is this expected value of the Hamiltonian. We're saying that the prior, P of Q, is going to be the entropic prior. And if you think about it, the likelihood is saying right here, so this is what we know, then that means that basically any Q is going to be consistent with that so long as the expected value of the Hamiltonian under Q has got that value. Thus, your probability of your data, which is this equality, given any particular Q, is just going to be that. OK? So this is what Bayes' theorem is saying. You know the expected value of your Hamiltonian. You're using the entropic prior, and the probability of any distribution that could have generated that expected value is this, a proportionality constants. I'm whipping through this, by the way, because of the time constraints. But if it gets to be just a little bit too much, the camel's back is starting to really get close to the ground, please tell me and rewind me. Should I rewind it here or keep going? Keep going? OK. So now, let me also go back again right here. The MAP is a good approximation to, for many situations, for many choices of loss function and so on. So let's say you want to predict one particular Q here. Properly speaking, you should minimize the expected loss. But let's say that you're just going to not want to worry about the actual loss function, but just go look at the mode of this creature. And say, that's my prediction for what this distribution will be. OK? So we're taking the mode of this binding the Q that maximizes the right-hand side. OK? Just look at what it does. This is a constraint to a feasibility region. And what we're really saying is I want to find a Q that maximizes this subject to that constraint. It's a constrained optimization problem. This is an exponential. So the MAP is the one that maximizes the entropy over everybody that meets the constraint. OK? Trivially simple. You pop it in, and guess what? You get the canonical ensemble. None of this stuff about heat baths and all that other kind of act. This is all just a it's all a point about our ignorance. By the way, notice that if you change your loss function, you should not predict the canonical ensemble in general. OK? And of course, you can go forward and do the similar kind of a thing where what you're, rather than just knowing the Hamiltonian, expected value of the Hamiltonian, you know, say, for example, expected number of particles, so on and so forth. This is what Jane showed in 57. And basically, it was only after I saw this that I started to think that statistical physics wasn't just a load of. This is what it amounts to. It's statistical physics. OK. So that's all just part one, reviewing statistics and game theory. OK? OK. Now, again, before everybody falls asleep, this is the only idea in this talk. Human beings are physical objects. So it doesn't matter if we're talking about physics systems or humans in a game. You should be using Bayes' theorem or some kind of statistics approach. I mean, that's too dark now. It's based on the loss functions to our reasoning.
So let me try to go back. So what we want to do is that, instead of considering Nash equilibrium where everybody has the same Q of X.
No, that's not true that everybody has the same Q of X.
No, it's not. OK, no, but they have a fixed one, right? It's a fixed one.
Everybody's got their own fixed distribution.
Yeah, sorry, no, that's the same, but a fixed one. So what you're doing is considering a distribution of them. So
a probability distribution across the Qs.
Across the Qs.
exactly.
You showed this example of that probability, I don't know why, but the entropic thing, okay?
Because that's one that there's information theoretic zero-rata that argue in favor of it, and I'm going to apply them here.
And it tells you that the most likely one.
When you know nothing else.
But the, nothing else but the mean, then.
Oh, that one then is the canonical.
Then it's the canonical. Okay.
Yep. Yep, exactly so. But by the way, no, that was a lot easier. You only had one Hamiltonian. Human beings are tough. We have as many Hamiltonians, quote unquote, as there are particles. That's why, like, if you look at a lot of the quantum physics papers, they have one Hamiltonian to rule them all. And that's why, for example, they don't get things like fold catastrophes. They only get discontinuities when they have a phase transition in the infinite limit, because they don't even realize, they don't incorporate the fact that human beings, natural way to model them, is not with a single Hamiltonian for all of them, for a different one for every different player. Okay. So one implication of all this straight off the bat is that you can throw away economics of the past century. Since humans are physical objects, we're going to have a probability distribution over all of their possible joint mix strategies. Nash equilibrium notions are wrong. You're going to have non-zero probability in general over every possibility. This, by the way, gives you automatically bounded rationality. In other words, human beings who are not going to be doing the perfect thing, given what everybody else is doing. Now, let's say, continuing on with this, let's say that you had some distribution over possible joint mix strategies of the players in this room, and let's say you did want to distill that down to a single prediction. You are Paulson going before Congress, and Congress doesn't even want to know what's the probability distribution of the joint mix strategies of all the players in the U.S. economy 6 months from now. Here you go. What they want to know is just tell me, actually they want to mean simply, they want to tell me, give me a single prediction for that joint mix strategy, and of course what they would really want is moments of that, like for example what the associated mining values would be. Well, to answer that, you're going to use Safra's axiom, supply a loss function. That's external to the game. It is not specified in the game specification. It's specified by the scientist, the statistician, the nerd, who's making the prediction. Change the loss function, you get a different prediction for the exact same game. That's what I was alluding to before. If you replace Paulson with Bernanke, they're going to have different loss functions. There will be different implications for their future income based upon if they predict this and the truth is that. So they should actually tell Congress different things. Okay? Notice, by the way, that in general, the Bayes-Offer prediction, the the prediction that minimizes expected loss, almost always over the space of games, gets messy, but almost always, that's a unique answer. You're just trying to find that minimum of the expected loss. For example, here it's a unique answer. It's just the mean is what minimizes it. So you don't have this problem of multiple equilibria that Nash had. Problem solved. Okay. Now, there's another way you can actually take a P of Q of I, given I, given iota, and distill it down to a single prediction of a joint mix strategy without using a loss function. There is a very simple way to do that. You marginalize it out. Yes?
The limit method, whole limit, right? When in fact all the players themselves using Nash equilibrium, it's the introduction of the loss function that now breaks the degeneracy of all those Nash equilibria.
Exactly.
So. Okay.
Exactly. So. But actually, there's another way you can also do it. Remember, what Q is itself is a probability distribution. So we have a probability distribution over probability distributions. But what we really want is simply one single probability distribution. Say that 10 times fast. One way to do that is to just to integrate out one of these parentheses brackets. You basically marginalize. If I want to know the probability distribution over joint moves, and without any loss function, one way to get it is to simply integrate out the probability distribution over joint mix strategies. And in general, this, of course, is going to be the unique answer.
This does not actually give you anything that a conventional economist would be happy about, because as I'm going to illustrate, it's got some really nasty properties. That's no longer a product distribution. Basically, because the sum of products is not the product of sums. So if there's multiple Nash equilibria for us in this room, then if you do that marginalization, so somebody outside who's predicting what's going on in this room, he's going to see apparent statistical coupling, even though there's actually none. Intuitively, what's happening is that if he sees my move, that tells him something about which Nash equilibrium we are playing, and that, therefore, tells him something about Sam's move. So even though it is true that we are all independent, because which equilibrium we are independent about is because there's more than one, he will still learn something about one of our moves by looking at what another one did. Okay? All right, so that's all nice gobbledygook. Now let's go forward and actually try to put up or shut up. What we need to do is write down that probability distribution. It's nice to say that, Nash equilibrium is wrong. Well, what's right? What can we actually do to be able to make predictions? Well, the prior, as I said, if you consider the canonical ensemble as, millions of high school student experiments that validate the entropic prior. So we'll go with that. But the question is, what do we do for likelihood? What I know is the utility function of the players, that's my data. What in the world can I write down for that? And I'm going to slowly build up an answer to that problem by going through some intermediate cases. Hopefully this example will make things more concrete. This, to get back to Lee's point, is a real, real drop-dead simple example of a non-cooperative game for two players. This is a common payoff game. It's what's the problem is it's called a coordination game in literature. Both players, I'm assuming in this case, actually have the same utility function. There's a column player who can go left or right. There's a row player who can go top or down. And they've got the exact same utility function, so I only need to say put one number in each cell to say what their joint value would be if they make that particular joint move. So for example, if I'm the column and I go left, and if Sam goes top, then we both get a 2. Okay? This game has 3 Nash equilibria. One of them is top left, because, for example, I'm saying, given what Sam's doing, given that he's going top, I am happy to go left. I don't want to go right. And he is saying, okay, given that David's going left, I'm happy going top. I don't want to go down. So that's a Nash equilibrium. But there's also a Nash equilibrium at the bottom right. Because again, I'm saying, okay, given what Sam's doing, that he's now going down, I want to go right, I don't want to go left. And he's saying a similar kind of thing going the other way. And it actually turns out there's one more, a nice little factoid. It turns out that almost every game has an odd number of Nash equilibria for peculiar reasons. So anyway, so this is our game, and let's,
Nash equilibrium?
Oh, it's going to be where they are playing joint mixed strategies. They're going to have probability distributions that are not delta functions. They're going to be fully mixed. That's what it comes out. Okay? So we want to say, so there's those three, and so let's say our likelihood is that we simply know more economics. What all the economists say, that it is going to be a Nash equilibrium. Somehow you know that. You know that everybody is able to play a Nash equilibrium. So the question, though, still becomes, okay, we got 3 equilibria. If what game theory is telling me that there are 3 equilibria, if that's going to be of any use to me in the real world, I've got to give you the relative probabilities of those 3 equilibria. Otherwise, you're just sort of telling me nothing. So let's go forward and see what those relative probabilities are. Entropic prior, as always, that likelihood is saying that the only possible Q is a Nash equilibrium.
That's sort of my banner title up there. That's what you know about the system. It has to be in Nash equilibrium. Okay? So if you then just go forward and do that marginalization I was talking about. So I write down basically entropic prior, restricted in the simplex of possible joint mix strategies to only one of the three Nash equilibria. So I've only got three possible Qs, and the prior is what's weighting them. It's all that's weighting them. So I've got the entropy, so I've got E to the alpha entropy of Q for those three possible Qs. Given that, I now just marginalize it out and say, okay, well, what's the probability distribution across the actual joint move spaces? So it's entropic over the three possible Qs. Each Q gives me a distribution over moves. So I'm just going to average over that entropic to get a final distribution over moves. Here's what you get. A little bit of algebra. The probability of the Nash equilibrium up at the top is equal to the posterior probability of the one down at the bottom, and it's equal to that, where that is this business right here. This is the mixed strategy Nash equilibrium. Under this one, column player goes left probability one-third, goes right with probability two-thirds, and the row player goes on top with probability one-third and down with probably two-thirds. You can actually just work it through and show that the column player given that the row player is playing that distribution, the column player could not benefit by changing, and vice versa. So these are the three Nash equilibria, and there are their relative probabilities. That's basically just evaluating E the alpha entropy for those three possible distributions.
Right. In that the players are indifferent to changing. Rather than being penalized for changing, they're indifferent.
Correct. Correct. Yep. You just do that in your head. That's pretty fast.
Wouldn't that suggest that they're likely to deviate away from it?
Very, very nice. Oh, yeah. And you're not thinking like a good game theoretician, but you are thinking like a scientist. And yes, there's a lot that you can do from that. Okay? So this is the posterior over Qs, or the three possible Qs, given what our likelihood is only three possible Qs. And now we're going to marginalize it down to see what actually says the probability distribution across our joint moves. So there's four possible joint moves, and here's what the probabilities turn out to be. Notice that every possible joint move can now occur. So even though your information is that it's a Nash equilibrium, just top, left, bottom, right, or the mixed, you're now getting all of those. Even though both players would prefer to be top left to being bottom right, the probability of being bottom right is actually higher than of being top left. Essentially because that mixed distribution is weighted down there. Now this is an example of what I was talking about before. Under this distribution, the players are actually statistically coupled. So even though I know that they're playing one of the three Nash equilibria, and those three Nash equilibria are all in each of them, the players are independent, once I just average across them, I get an apparent coupling. So for example, in an economy, that would mean things like there appears to be collusion between two businesses when there in fact is not. You will see statistical artifacts of that sort. Also, neither player, under that distribution, that P of X given I, neither player is playing Nash against the other one. Both of them, for both of them, you just marginalize it down. You're saying, given what the other one's distribution is, I could have done better. So it's going to automatically appear like bounded rationality. And there's a whole bunch of experimental literature on people demonstrating bounded rationality, and nobody knows why. You can do the exact same thing for the case where your likelihood is not, oh, they are playing Nash equilibrium, but the likelihood is instead, oh, they are playing a particular quantum response with a particular set of temperatures, the two players. You can just run through the exact same kind of machinery. Okay? Oh, man. Okay. So, that was number two.
And I'm afraid this is going to be like a Zeno's paradox. I'm going to move faster and faster. But now let's say, OK. In the. That right, that is something to be an NSF grant proposal.
It seems impossible that, I mean, your prediction is that people will actually tend to play the bottom or the right.
Only in that particular case, but also notice that that was all for saying that we, our knowledge, our data, is that they are playing a Nash equilibrium.
So that seems to validate the assumption of playing Nash equilibrium. And I expected, like, 800 graduates to problem. They would all be top left, right? Everyone would be trying to get the two.
A word of caution. I wasn't being completely glib when I said the approximation of undergraduate. When you run these experiments, people behave in very, very weird ways. And they do very stupid things.
No one's got this, but you're making a prediction that people will do something.
No, I'm not, because I would not take that likelihood of being Nash. I would say
okay.
So I would not adopt that likelihood.
Which likelihood? Okay.
And that's what I'm getting to now.
Thank you.
And by the way, in a certain sense, intuitively, why there's more weight on the bottom right than top left, it's kind of like a density of states situation.
Well, you have a centropic prior, right?
Which is
so you're weighting the mixed strategy somewhat more.
And the entropic prior itself comes from Klein arguments, exactly the way it does in the original heat bath kinds of formulations in physics.
Mm-hmm. Also, I don't want to delay you, so let's.
Mm-hmm. Very quick, yeah.
Yeah, just curious whether I'm understanding correctly. You're basically deriving probabilities for what, you know, what I should expect people to play.
So based upon the information that, because somebody told you, a little bird whispered in your ear, oh, they played a Nash equilibrium.
You're given that as a promise, they're going to play a Nash equilibrium. And then you want to come up with some sort of estimate of, you know, what's the relative likelihood that you're going to play a different Nash equilibrium.
Relative probability, likelihood's got a special meaning.
Sure.
Well, yeah, what's the relative probability?
But the final probabilities you get that you just calculated on the previous overhead, that's not a strategy because we assume the two players can't communicate, and therefore they can't generate a correlated probability distribution.
This is what you external to the game would write down as the probabilities. And what you could then imagine doing is if I had many experiments with many pairs of students, and each one of them that bird happened to whisper in my ear and I believed it, then I would just run through and do frequency counts. And how often across all those experiments do I see top left versus down right is the actual move that they do. And this is what would come out.
So what's the point of the
experiment one, they played Nash equilibrium one. Experiment two, they played.
Oh, the same thing, but this is just a marginalization. It just follows from this right here. This is saying what the relative probabilities are across all those experiments of the various possible Nash equilibria.
I guess all I'm asking is, I can see how that's interesting. Why are the other numbers interesting?
For a game theoretician, this is abstraction. What this is saying is that the traditional equilibrium concept is saying pick one of the Nash equilibria. That's what they want to do. They want to have what's called a refinement, which is a way to actually always make a unique prediction, because they know, sort of intuitively, since they don't have probabilities, if you have multiple Nash equilibria coming out, you're saying it's going to be a Nash equilibrium that is at least partially vacuous. Never even mind if it's correct or not. You haven't actually given an answer to the problem. So what they're going to do is they've got this whole literature on other conditions that you can add to the Nash equilibria definition to try to winnow down the number of equilibria. And always the holy grail of this thing called an equilibrium concept, which is how do you come up and predict the one single joint mix strategy that is always going to occur. So what I'm saying here is, well, if you always are going to want to make one particular unique prediction, one way to do it would be with a loss function, in which case nothing's defined until you have a loss function. Okay, game theoreticians, you don't want to do that. Another way to do it is just this marginalization, because that does give you a unique prediction of what you're going to see in experiment.
So you're saying take the highest of those probabilities and predict that mixed
strategy? No, I'm saying predict that distribution.
Oh, predict that distribution.
Yeah, it's like I've got a random Poisson process. And what am I going to predict? I'm going to predict, well, it's a random Poisson process. And I'm just going to keep on looking at that little P
piece of uranium decaying, and I'm going to see it matches onto a Poisson process. And that's what this is.
Is it right to say that ultimately you're testing the idea that, you know?
Perhaps we can go get to this later.
Sure.
Because we've only got 10 minutes left. How that is going to manage. Okay. Now, once you do run these experiments.
Yeah, I wish we had more time, but I've got this hard cutoff at 5 o'clock. when you do run these experiments, and of course, just simply with introspection, in the real world, obviously, every joint mix strategy has non-zero probability. These are human beings. These are messy little neurons that are firing. There are people who are half asleep. They do, not just when they do the experiments, but in general, how much caffeine they've got, how zoned they are, and so on. So people are going to vary. So we want to construct a likelihood that allows that. I am not going to stake a flag in the sand saying this is the way to do it. But this is more of an existence proof, so to speak, showing that you can actually get a reasonable likelihood that actually does have that character. This is the one that we're right now doing the using for the numerical calculation predictions about weather disruptions in national airspace. So here's how you do it. I'm going to build it up in stages. Let's start with a quantum response for some set of rationalities, some set of temperatures. So we're just going to start saying, okay, everybody in this room, we've got our temperatures. And, you know, I'm right now really, really hot. Maybe some of the people who are falling asleep, they're really cold, whatever. And we're going to start with that. Now, the axioms on von Neumann-Morgenstern theory say that any human being, all that they're interested in is their expected utility. They don't care about anything else. Let's go with that. Then what that means is that for me, we're starting at this quantum response equilibrium. So I'm doing a Boltzmann distribution over my environment, which is specified by you guys. So, but what point three means is that given that environment you've specified, I actually would be just as happy if I weren't playing a Boltzmann distribution, but we're playing something else that had the same expected utility. I'm agnostic between them all. Okay, so you can see how this is starting to allow things to open up, because I'm now saying any probability distribution that Wolpert might play, so long as it's got the right expectation value, so long as the expected energy is right, any one of them is going to be one that Wolpert's just as happy with. This is a way that game theory differs from like conventional physics. And I'm basically saying that all I care about is this expected value. And so anything that gives me that expected value is just as good as any other. Now let's extend things further. Let's say that I'm going to make that allowance for me, that I am agnostic in that sense, even when you guys are not playing the Boltzmann distribution. In other words, whatever your distribution is, I've got some temperature, and I'm going to be equal. So you specify my environment, and I've got some temperature, and I'm going to be equally happy with any distribution I might play that gives me the same expected value as it would if I were doing Boltzmann with that temperature. So sort of in the language of physics, where it was only a single particle, say, and you're talking about expected energy, it's basically saying any distribution, but given some particular temperature, you define the expected energy, and it's then saying, under the Boltzmann distribution, and it's then saying, well, actually, in fact, any distribution that has that particular expected energy is acceptable as any other one. So the temperature is only being used to parameterize, in essence, the map from what everybody else in the environment does to my expected energy. So that's the only thing that's a constant about me is my temperature. Okay? So here's like a little example. This is my environment defined by you. So these are, I can make four possible moves, and this is my expected utility if I make this move, and that move. That's what's going along this axis. Here is the relative probability I assign to those moves. The Boltzmann distribution one, for some particular value of beta, would be this blue diamonds. But what I'm saying is that, okay, given that player is only concerned with expected utility, if it turns out the red diamonds have the same expected utility as the blue diamonds, then I'm fine with either one. I don't care. Or to put another way, given how smart I am, given how rational I am, I'm just as likely to come up with one or the other, because all of my rationality, all my smarts are directed at maximizing expected utility.
Okay.
So, well, as I say, so beta I measures how rational, and you can see what the connection with the conical ensemble is. So then what you say is that of all q that are allowed by this likelihood, it turns out when you do the calculation, those which locally maximize the entropy, in other words, those that are MAP, give you a correction term to quantum response. There's a lot of experimental data trying to say that quantum response works. That it actually characterizes real world experimental behavior. But there are lots of discrepancies. What you can now say is maximizing entropy, just like you would under the MAP approach to deriving the conical ensemble, for this new likelihood, you actually get correction terms to the quantum response. And you can see when those correction terms should be big and when they should be small.
If all the players were very cold, what would they do?
If they're all very cold, then
are we out of time already?
Yeah.
We are?
No, that this is my phone actually ringing.
So oh, okay. Ringing, oh. Best of the 20th century.
Yeah.
That case, if they're all very cold, and what that's going to mean is that you're going to be getting close to them being the posterior over Qs will be getting very, very concentrated about the free Nash equilibrium.
Okay, so that's an unusual definition of rational, right? These hyper-rational players are not playing what I would think of as a very good strategy.
No, it's them jointly. See, this is actually causing coupling. What it's saying is that if I'm very close to cold, then what that means is that I actually am going to be doing almost as well as I can, given what you're doing, and then vice versa. But there's a whole bunch of solutions to that.
Because they don't actually know that all the other players are super rational despite the coordination problem. I see. Thank you. Okay.
Yeah.
Geez, I got a couple of this is obviously not going to go. Where should I end it off?
Let me just then quickly say something about airline behavior. We're investigating this for the following kind of domain now. Here's an example of what happens to you when you are so unfortunate as to get a airline delay. There are things that are called ground delay programs. GDP does not mean GDP. And basically, the FAA will institute a ground delay program for all flights into Chicago when Chicago is being socked in with weather. What that means is that anybody who is going to fly into Chicago, you are delayed on the ground, hence the name, so that they don't actually exceed the capacity of the sink of Chicago to absorb all those flights due to the bad weather. So they've got to decide who stays on the ground for how long. This is where those tens of billions of dollars are being lost. So here's an example. You've got three airlines, A, B, and C, and they have their flight numbers, and with the ERTA, that's called the earliest time of arrival. So for that particular flight, under normal conditions, for the top, on the top, the earliest you could arrive is 1, the second one could arrive at 1, but then you go on to 1:20. And then you have the confirmed time of arrival is when they're scheduled to arrive. That's the last one. Now you suddenly say, oops, we got to put in a ground delay program. We are not allowed to have 5 flights coming in the next hour like we have there, but only 3. Right now, there is a very rigid, the airlines have no input, it's an algorithm that they run to decide who gets to be those 3. The airlines hate this because it doesn't optimize things and they lose a lot of money. So people are talking about having auctions amongst the airlines dynamically where they, in essence, compete against one another to come up with the magic of the marketplace solution that should be best for everybody. And so what we're doing is investigating, for this particular scenario, for different choices of the auction, you're going to have a different game that the airlines are playing with one another. And we are now actually making the predictions of what kinds of distributions they're going to play, what their joint mix strategy will be in that game. In other words, what bids they're going to be making. Distribution, because these are their moves. In this game, every airline's move is its bids. And if you put the bids all together, then it goes to a little, the bids are compared to one another and you get the final outcome. And this is where they actually get or lose real dollars. Because this final outcome says, ooh, I've got to cancel my flight. Or, oh, my flight's not going to make this connection. Or not just my passengers, it's actually the hardware. The airplane is scheduled to make a subsequent connection and it won't be able to. So that's what's going on here. And so we're actually going to be able to now compare different auction speeds, make predictions for which one would actually, for example, to something very simple, maximize the sum of the expected payoffs to all the airlines. So when they're all going about trying to play the game as well as they can, the greedy bastards for this auction, how well do they all actually end up doing? And when you do the different game for a different auction, how well do they end up doing? So this would, for example, provide the FAA with a way for just choosing between different options. I'm already over, so I guess we'll end it there. So is everybody off then to the cake and cookies, or are there any questions?
Anybody stick around for questions if you like? Got Dave for David's forego the birthday festivities for a few minutes.
Yeah.
You'd like, but feel free to.
Yeah, okay, so I can ask you a question, it's great.
So what I'm having trouble understanding is, suppose you have some players who are non-zero temperature, so they're not entirely rational.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just take the example that you gave with three Nash equilibria. We got two pure, one mixed strategy. The entropy of the mixed strategy is greater than the entropy of the pure strategies. That says that a not wholly rational player.
The pure strategies have minimal entropy.
Right.
Yeah, oh, I'm sorry, I thought you said the other way around.
Yeah, okay. So the mixed strategy has more.
Yes, correct.
So that would be saying that a not wholly rational player is more likely to play the mixed strategy than the pure strategies.
No, because these are all purely rational players. The mixed strategy in Nash equilibrium is in that particular equilibrium, that's this one here, and they are being both purely rational. Given that you're playing a probability distribution, I am also going to be completely happy with this probability distribution. I, by changing it, will not make life better for me. So even though I've got it,
okay, I grant that. Okay. But you know, given that there are multiple Nash equilibria, you know, you have to make a decision what Nash equilibrium you're going to play.
Well, actually, that's not up to me.
That's not up to
it's you. Up to the pair of us. If it's a Nash, if what we know is a Nash equilibrium, that means that somehow by magic, we ended up choosing the same Nash equilibrium to play.
Are we allowed in this game to speak to one another about which Nash equilibrium we want to play? No.
What you're getting at is some of the foundational problems with game theory. Conventional economics is based on the notion of Nash equilibrium, and the obvious question is how do they choose the same Nash equilibrium? There are things where it's what's called the purification theorem. People have been worrying about that for decades.
But it's not one of the assumptions. So the assumption is there's no communication, correct?
In the textbook, it will say no communication. When you actually take a game theoretician and sign them against the wall at a conference, and say, how can they possibly do this? They'll say, okay, in the real world, then there's either some direct interaction between the players, or there's indirect that's being mediated by social norms.
So you're making predictions about how people are going to play here in your analysis, and you are assuming that they're not communicating. So you're making predictions for the
I'm only assuming that whatever the process is, that gives me that likelihood that we know that they're playing a Nash equilibrium. Whether that means that they implicitly communicated beforehand, or whether it means it was mediated by social norms, which steered them to one particular Nash equilibrium, whatever it is, I'm completely ignorant of that. All that I know is that they are playing a Nash equilibrium. I know nothing else about how. And I don't know anything about that other process. All I see is the very tip of the iceberg, this game.
So I guess my real question is just, can you give any kind of reasoning why one would assign a higher probability to the Nash equilibrium, which it has a mixed strategy, you know, which is the one that has the higher entropy? So in physics, there are reasons to assign higher probability to things that have higher entropy.
It's
here, in terms of decision theory, why should agents who are rational
implicitly what one is doing, To drill it back, you go back to the arguments underlying information theory arguments for why and entropic prior. Mm-hmm. And they have to do with basically counting. They do it with an infinite number of samples of a distribution, what actual kind of frequency distributions will end up being most frequent. It's basically a Stirling's approximation. Now, what you are saying is what you're instead doing is somehow averaging over all possible ways that they may have coordinated the same Nash equilibrium, whether they know each other from beforehand or whether there's social norms or whatnot being averaged over. What you're saying is that you don't see it as an a priori reason why such averaging would give you an entropic prior. I agree. This, remember, I gave that caveat, I'm not staking. In fact, we're right now exploring things other than entropic prior. I'm not going to put a stake in the sand saying that this is an existence proof of saying one can do it. The proper way to actually do all of what I'm showing right now, despite the fact that we're physicists, at least I was once, the proper way to do all of this is not to sit here and make airy-fairy arguments about entropic priors. It's to go in and actually look at the psychology data and look at what's called behavioral game theory, where there's lots and lots of these experiments about how humans behave. Quantify that, for example, in what's called a Bayes net, and have that drive the distributions. That's the proper way to do it, which is a really long-winded way of saying, I agree with you.
Any other questions? Well, thank David again.